You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa. No mahaere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire Wharahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Thomas. If I can, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about increasing fuel prices, public transport, and the scrapped clean car discount. I also spoke to Professor Alistair Woodward from the University of Auckland about air pollution, how to address it, and we also touched on the clean car discount. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Forest and Bird National Conservation Advocate Bianca Ransom about the proposed Fisheries Act Amendment Bill and the risk it poses to our oceans. And I also talked to University of Auckland Senior Research Fellow Dr. Kelly Garton about the New Zealand's increasing junk food imports and the detrimental health effects this could have on the country.
He aha or whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Or why might I give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e warawere e koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere roki mā runga i te pai, tuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The US and Israel's war on Iran and the subsequent closure of the Strait of Hormuz has fuel prices increasing across the country. As fuel prices increase, people are continually looking towards alternatives, primarily public transport and electric vehicles. With public transport use at a 7-year high last week and demand for electric vehicles increasing, demand seems to contradict government policy. Since the start of its term, this government has been cutting discounts to public transport and cutting incentives to buy electric vehicles. At the same time, the government has touted investments in LNG and offshore oil and gas exploration as the solutions to New Zealand's energy woes. As fuel prices continue to rise, so too does the cost of living, with prices in supermarkets already spiking and hitting consumers where many are already struggling. Despite the government's campaigning and signalling around cost of living, prices are continuing to rise without a similar increase to wages. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I asked him about the fuel crisis and the lessons that the government is taking. We've seen fuel prices going up these past few weeks as a consequence of the conflict in the Middle East, and Finance Minister Nicola Willis is still acting relatively confident in the news media talking about the effect on the New Zealand economy. What is the government doing to address the increase in prices?
Well, higher fuel prices are definitely hitting households right now, and people are feeling it every time they fill up. But you know, we do have to be conscious that these things are driven by global pressures. And so, you know, ACT would say the government's job is to respond in a way that actually helps people without making things worse. And I understand Nicola Willis, the finance minister, is getting advice on what options the government has available, and that there is an intention to move quickly and not wait till people are really doing it tough. But you know, any support that the government provides to people will need to be very targeted and temporary based on the actual energy or fuel costs that people are suffering, because we just don't want to repeat the mistakes of the previous government with broad inflationary spending at a time when, you know, New Zealand has just had its future credit rating put on negative watch by Fitch because of our debt situation and our spending spending commitments in the future.
Last week saw a 7-year high for public transport use in Auckland. However, there's also been reports of overcrowding on some buses and trains. Is this a sign that we should have invested more in our public transport infrastructure in the past, or maybe should be learning from this and investing more in future?
Well, it's fantastic to know that there is demand for this service. I mean, between taxpayers and Auckland ratepayers, they will have paid somewhere between $6 to $7 billion for the City Rail Link stations and services, which are due to come online later this year. So if people are seeing the benefits of using public transport, they don't have very long to wait before they get access to a world-class piece of infrastructure. But, you know, we've got to compare that to Wellington, where their regional council has had a look at patronage, and over the past 4 to 5 years, patronage has dropped off 30 to 40%. They got a whole idle bus fleet, and, you know, and trains with hardly anyone on them, outside of a much reduced peak demand. And that's because people in this part of New Zealand have either chosen to work from home, or their employers have said you can work from home, or they're just deciding to work in different places and not come into the Wellington CBD. So look, it's horses for courses, but it's great that there's people, fighting for a seat on the bus, and it bodes well for utilisation of this fantastic asset that's just been created for Aucklanders and CRL.
There's been calls from council and from the public and various activists as well for the government or for council to reduce public transport fares in this time where people are struggling with fuel prices. Is that something that the government's willing to look into?
Well, it seems counterproductive, doesn't it? I mean, you just, on one hand, saying there's never been greater demand for the buses, so and public transport, which indicates people are willing to pay for that service. So why on earth would the government, you know, smack itself in the face by saying, oh, now we're going to transfer a whole lot of money from one group of taxpayers to a group of bus riders who do seem willing and able to pay for it? That doesn't make any sense at all to act. But, you know, sometimes we are the only people who make sense. And so, you know, people are just going to have to get used to paying for things, paying a bit more for things in the meantime, I think.
And on that, people getting used to paying a bit more for things, we've seen prices go up as well, not just for fuel, but also for some products in grocery stores, some products in other stores as well, due to increased costs of freight and whatnot. Is the government, I mean, we've seen the cost of living go up in the past few years, and the government has not done a lot to, or it hasn't been very effective, rather, in reducing the cost of living there. Is the government planning any other changes to address this new spike?
Well, it's true that the cost of fuel means that the cost of everything from harvesting the vegetables and crops through to transporting food to supermarkets has increased as a result. I understand that the government is looking into what kind of targeted relief measures are possible for certain groups of people who are most vulnerable to these type of changes in the cost of living. But in terms of what the government has done, when the ACT, National New Zealand First Coalition government, came into office, inflation was running at 7% per annum, and between the extraordinary spending and borrowing of the previous government and the fact that, you know, large parts of the economy were essentially overheated and beyond capacity, like the building and construction industry, for example, the price of everything was going up much faster than it is now. We've got inflation down to around about 3%, and while it could be lower, what that means is that instead of prices compounding by 7% every year, year on year, we've actually got it down to a level that is very close to the Reserve Bank's target range. And so, you know, future New Zealanders won't feel the same things that current Kiwis do, where house prices spike by 30 to 40% like they did under the last government, and the cost of food, of basic food items, have increased significantly as well. So we have done a lot, and we've done that by reducing borrowing, reducing spending, particularly wasteful spending at the margins, and making sure that the government's own actions aren't contributing to inflationary pressures.
And I want to segue some of this fuel crisis stuff into the government's climate policy. We've seen right now, as fuel prices have gone up, some of the big winners, or some of the big people who have been less affected, are some of those who own EVs or hybrid vehicles, right? The government, at the start of its term, scrapped the clean car discount. How is that looking now with people, you know, those who have EVs are obviously not as affected by this fuel insecurity? Is that something that the government is looking back at and going, maybe we shouldn't have done this?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, what you're describing is the market working perfectly. You know, I heard an EV dealer on the radio talking about his sales from the previous weekend, saying that, you know, rather than selling 20 to 25 vehicles, EVs on a weekend, they'd sold nearly 80. Now, you know, the government doesn't need to give demand a push when demand is high. That is a fallacy, and that is why ACT exists, and that's why we are playing a really constructive role in government by continuing to remind people who would call for more transfers of wealth from one group of taxpayers to another. That's essentially what the EV subsidy scheme was, transfers from tradies, farmers, and people with large families who needed larger vehicles, a transfer of wealth from them to a group of privileged people who got, you know, around about $7,000 cash back to buy an EV. Instead of that, you say, hey, when fuel prices get a bit higher, people might actually switch to it of their own volition. And that's exactly what we're seeing, and ACT absolutely celebrates that.
And is this pointing to, as well, the government's also been investing a lot in, I mean, there's talks of the LNG terminal, there's the return to offshore oil and gas exploration, and there's been other climate policies there around reducing our reliance on clean energy sources and looking more into oil and gas. Is that coming into question now as well, now that we're seeing that the global oil and gas trade networks are a bit tenuous, you know, they're not as reliable as they may have seemed in the past?
Well, it's absolutely vital we have a diversified energy supply. And, you know, just push back on some of the potentially inaccurate things you've said. New Zealand has 85% of its electricity generation typically renewable. Sometimes it's been up to 100%. And you know, renewables make up 45% of our overall total primary energy supply. That includes liquid fuels, stuff you might put in your car. So we're already very resilient when it comes to our energy diversity. But of course we have to have natural gas. It powers all kinds of industries, including manufacturing. You know, if you buy a pie from the bakery or you buy a loaf of bread from the supermarket, it's more than likely it's been baked in an oven that's powered by natural gas. And the best way to ensure New Zealand's energy security is to make sure that we go out and we drill for and we produce our own indigenous gas here, and that, you know, if we do need to be connected to the rest of the world as a backup, we've got that through the LNG terminal. But there is no country in the world that is succeeding right now in delivering better quality of life for its people, but they've decided to turn off gas. You look at the UK, energy prices are at least two times higher than they would have been if they still had developed their own gas. You've got their energy minister saying, oh, we're not going to go back to the North Sea and drill for more gas, even though it's there, because they're still pursuing their idealistic net zero policies. You know, we have to make sure that the climate policies actually work and that they're actually affordable, because you can set ambitious targets, but if they don't stack up economically and financially, they won't be sustainable or durable. And that's why New Zealand is taking the path that we have, which is, you know, let the emissions trading scheme do the work, put a price on carbon, and then let consumers and industries decide how they're going to manage that.
And I think that's some of the big stuff here, the consumers and industries managing things themselves. You mentioned that the country at large is largely reliant on renewable fuel sources. However, people in their day-to-day lives are often using a lot of petrol in their cars, right? And this is something that the government has, I mean, largely encouraged, right? By scrapping the clean car discount, people have been pushed back into buying cars that use petrol. And many of the cars in Auckland CBD are not those belonging to big families or farmers or whatever. These big cars, these utes in Auckland, many people are driving alone in those every day. There's nothing in the back of the car. And so I think what I'm questioning here is the role of government in pushing this change. Should the government not be more involved in encouraging people to move towards cleaner cars, which are not only better for the environment, but also more resilient in times of crisis that we're seeing right now?
Look, ACT campaigned against the so-called clean car discount and clean car standard. It's nanny statism as it worse. You had the previous Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, wagging her finger from the beehive, telling people that they weren't allowed to drive utes unless they had a legitimate purpose to do so. They got kicked out, and the new government says, actually, you choose the vehicle that you want. if you're prepared to pay for the fuel for a larger vehicle, that's your choice. If you want to go out and buy an EV, well, right now, today, there's probably never been a better time to make that decision because of the price of fuel. That is markets working as markets are intended to do. There's a huge influx of relatively low-priced new EVs, including utes, if tradies want to go and buy a BYD. And judging by the number I see around in Auckland, they're pretty darn popular. So you know, the ACT position would be there's nothing that the government needs to do that the market will not already do for you. And if the government does get involved, all that's likely to do is transfer wealth from one group of New Zealanders to another who probably don't need it, as we saw with the EV subsidies going to mostly wealthy people buying new vehicles under the previous Labor Green coalition government. And in the end, you know, we're going to have a huge influx of cheaper, lower emissions vehicles coming out of our major suppliers in places like Japan and China over the next decade that are going to largely replace the fleet that we've got now. But it won't happen because a government decides to start transferring wealth from one group of Kiwis to another. It'll happen because that's what markets do.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about the fuel crisis and the lessons that the government is taking from it.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat. This is You Could Lose It by Miles Calder.
You could lose. The visionary Kim Gordon is back with a record that tells you what to do on the packet. Play me, and we're happy to oblige because it's a banger. Tell me what you want, you have to see. Your mates on 95BFM Drive are giving away copies of the album all week to B-card holders. So tune in, turn on those Tardinga, and await your cue to enter. Play Me, the new album from Kim Gordon. Available now wherever fine music is sold.
For my next move, I activate my Blue Eyes White Dragon.
You'd think that would scare me, but I'm taking off my mask and pulling out my face card.
Wait, is it my turn? I don't know the rules of this game, but I have a B card.
We're doomed!
The most powerful card in the deck, the B-card, provides you with the ultimate power, the ability to win tickets, albums, and more. Get a B-card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month.
You're listening to Talking Tracks on PBNZ.
And as I said, Frith, if this harpsichord is gauche, then what's Max Martin? Seriously though, a crisp and ebullient debut from this young artist. Mm. And now from our new contributor, Daryl?
Yeah, mate.
Are you trying to humiliate me?
No.
Is this funny to you? Screeching uncultured no-fi bullshit? Get out!
Real pain for sham friends. Dirtbag Radio. For real friends.
Cause I wanna go out and get drunk and dance.
Dirtbag Radio. Mondays 7 to 9 p.m. with Rapley. Thanks to Go Cooler Music, Auckland's newest secondhand music store at 370A Broadway Newmarket. Only on 95BFM.
Arcade Radio. Thursday nights 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio. For all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio Thursday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki.
Arcade Radio. Only on 95BFM.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire. Welcome back to The Wire. Thank you for all of your texts. Lovely stuff about the Simon Court interview there. Always appreciate
it. Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire. Last week also saw a study released around air pollution in Aotearoa, which found that Auckland faced significant air pollution risks. Traffic is one of the leading causes, with congestion and big vehicles as primary factors. Over 700 people in Auckland die annually from air pollution from traffic, more than any other part of the country. As the fuel crisis gets worse, many people are seeing it as an opportunity to improve our country by becoming less reliant on petrol and cutting out unnecessary large vehicles from our big cities. To discuss air pollution and the potential opportunities within the fuel crisis, I spoke to the University of Auckland's Professor Alistair Woodward. For people who aren't familiar with the concept, what is air pollution and what causes it?
Well, air pollution refers to what we breathe in. And the fact that sometimes it includes what we breathe in, includes dust and gases that can cause harm to our health. We call that air pollution. New Zealand on the whole has pretty good air, but one area that we do very badly in is traffic pollution. That's pollutants that come from motor vehicles. And it particularly includes a very irritating gas called nitrogen dioxide, which is generated when you burn fossil fuels, and fine particles, very small particles that get right down into the bottom of the lungs. So those are both known to be hazardous, and we've estimated that they probably cause roughly 400 premature deaths a year in Auckland. 400 to 700 in that range.
Are there any vehicles that would cause traffic pollution more than other kinds?
Yes, certainly. I mean, it's related to how much fuel cars burn. So obviously, bigger, heavier cars consume more petrol to go the same distance or diesel. And it's actually diesel that's particularly harmful because
that's particularly likely to produce nitrogen dioxide. So the most toxic vehicles from that point of view are large diesel vehicles.
Mm. And is that why we're seeing such a hotspot in Auckland, as well as all of the traffic, obviously, that comes in through all of our urban centres?
Yes, for sure. I mean, large diesel-powered buses are a problem, and, you know, Auckland Transport realises that, and that's one reason why our local network is shifting quite rapidly to electric buses, which is a great thing. But the other contributor is our diesel-powered utes, and most double cab utes are powered using diesel for various reasons. But if they're driven in the city, then, you know, they obviously add to the problem because they spew out more harmful pollutants than small petrol-driven cars.
And right now, I mean, it looks like a bit of a time of opportunity, right? Last week saw public transport usage at a 7-year high. We've seen fuel prices go up, which, while affecting people's cost of living, has also pushed people maybe out of their cars into the public transport networks. Are there lessons we could be taking from right now and policy changes we could be making to maybe keep these forward steps lasting into the future?
Oh, indeed. I think as well as being a time of great difficulty, this is a time of opportunity. And we just need to realise that New Zealand's transport system, which at present is very car dependent and depends on the use of internal combustion engine vehicles, is a strategic liability. So there are other reasons we want to cut back on climate emissions. We want a safer, quieter city. There are lots of reasons why we might want to reduce the amount of private vehicle, motor vehicle traffic, but the shortage of fossil fuels is just a powerful reminder of how a resilient transport network is one that doesn't depend so much on petrol and diesel.
And if we're thinking about policy changes in the past now, we saw the clean car discount put in place by the previous Labor government and then scrapped pretty early into this current government's term. Is that the sort of policy that we'd like to see? And how effective are policies like that in reducing air pollution?
Well, yes, I think that's a good point, because the clean car discount that the previous government introduced did provide financial incentives for people to buy low emission vehicles, and it was accompanied by a steep rise in the number of electric vehicles that people were buying. When the current government abandoned the clean car discount, the sales of electric vehicles reduced immediately. So we know that this does make a difference to people's decisions. And certainly if we want to reduce air pollution, we want to control climate gases, and we want to reduce our dependence on imported fossil fuels, then, you know, for three very good reasons, we should try and encourage people to move away from polluting motor vehicles to other transport options, including EVs.
Yeah, and are there any other policy changes you'd like to see?
Yes, I think we could put higher sales taxes on heavier vehicles. We could link vehicle registration charges to tailpipe emissions. We should restrict the entry of large vehicles to city centres and other high pedestrian zones. We should resist the pressure that we're already seeing to supersize parking spaces, because, of course, the big double cab utes either don't fit, or they fit only just into standard parking spaces, and the council's under pressure to, you know, enlarge parking spaces. So those are all, you know, practical suggestions that changes that could be made quite quickly.
That was the University of Auckland's Professor Alistair Woodward speaking to me about air pollution and potential opportunities within the fuel crisis.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Last week, Minister for Oceans and Fisheries, Shane Jones, introduced the Fisheries Act Amendment Bill to Parliament. The bill proposes sweeping changes to the current Fisheries Act, including scrapping minimum size limits for the majority of fish species, and introducing penalties for whistleblowers leaking onboard camera footage. The bill also ignores thousands of submissions calling for positive environmental changes to the Act, such as a ban on bottom trawling. The Act's defenders say the limited market for juvenile fish will financially punish commercial fishers for catching them, and claim that the Act can unlock commercial fishing's economic potential. Critics, however, have accused Shane Jones of giving in to commercial lobbyists and selling out New Zealand's environment for short-term economic gain. To discuss the changes made in the Act and their potential impact on Aotearoa's oceans, I talked to Forest and Bird National Conservation Advocate Bianca Ranson. Now, for our listeners who might not be aware, can you explain this Fisheries Act Amendment Bill and what concerns Forest and Bird have about it?
So the Fisheries Amendment Bill, there was an announcement that was made on Tuesday, and during the public's consultation there were around 27,000 submissions that were put forward raising concerns around the bill, and Forest and Bird were one of them. And since the announcement on Tuesday, one of real concern that has actually been added after public consultation is the removal of commercial minimum size limits, and that's for species like snapper, trevally, tarakihi, hooky, blue cod, pretty much all species actually, except for one or two. So in simple terms, what it means is that it will allow the commercial fishing industry to catch and sell baby fish, juvenile fish, before they have even had a chance to spawn. So it's really important that we have size limits in place pretty much as a cornerstone of fisheries management, and getting rid of it is just adding further pressure to our oceans and to our biodiversity, where many of the fish stocks are already at depleted numbers. By removing the baby fish before they have a chance to spawn means that they're not reproducing and just puts the entire food chain at risk. And also for recreational fishers or people just going out to go fishing for their whānau, it's going to have wide-reaching impacts.
On that minimum size limits being cut, Long Sea program lead Sam Wolford described it as killing the goose that lays golden eggs. What is the risk this bill threatens to young fish? And can you just go into the potential ecological impacts it could have?
So the risk that it poses is that you are removing juvenile fish which have the ability to reproduce. So it means that there's just no limit on what people can take. So bottom trawlers, for example, can scoop up everything and then go on to sell really small fish, which there's an extremely limited market for. A lot of this is 90% is being exported overseas, and there'd only be a really niche market that would be looking at, you know, juvenile fish, small fish. So the impacts on our ecosystems are huge. It's not just the removal of the commercial minimum size limits, but it's also the fishing practice of bottom trawling. So bottom trawling is one of the most destructive fishing methods on the planet. It's kind of heavy weighted nets that are dragged across the seafloor and they decimate everything in their path. So the benthic environment is extremely important as a nursery and ecosystems for fish like snapper and for lots of other life. But when you have a bottom trawler go through there, it just removes all of that. And it also releases a lot of sediment, so there's huge sedimentation blooms. And also, one thing that people don't know about bottom trawling is that the release of carbon is equivalent to the entire aviation industry on the planet. So globally, bottom trawling is just as harmful in terms of carbon release as flying. But just to come back more to the point that you've just raised, you know, if we've got that destructive fishing method happening in somewhere like the Hauraki Gulf that has 26 years of reports just showing the steady decline of biodiversity and ecosystem well-being, and then you allow any fish to be taken out of the ocean, it's just the ripple on effect is that we're not in any way securing abundance for future generations. We're in fact doing the opposite. So what we're seeing here is short-term economic gain, mostly for export purposes, being put over sustainable fishing methods and ecosystem-based fisheries management, which Fisheries New Zealand has committed to. And this is, yeah, just the opposite. It's actually just unfathomable that this would even be put forward, and there's a massive amount of uproar across pretty much all industries and stakeholders except for the commercial industry. So we just can't afford to be putting this extra pressure on our oceans that are already struggling, and we need to make sure that we kill the bill, that we don't allow it to go through first reading. And the way for people to help with that is to reach out to your local MP. You can email the Prime Minister, and these parties need to know that if they support this through first reading, that they don't have the support of the people. The power is really in our hands, and we need cross-party support to kill the bill, because once it goes through to select committee, it's extremely hard to make changes when it gets to that stage. But what you're seeing at the moment is environmentalists, recreational fishers, communities, all rallying to raise awareness of this issue and make sure that the bill doesn't proceed any further.
And the person behind this bill, the Minister, Shane Jones, has been accused by critics of appeasing commercial lobbyists. And while he's denied these claims, he's also in the past called himself the commercial fishing apostle. Do you think this bill has come to directly benefit those commercial fishing industries?
Oh, no doubt about it. 100%. This is absolutely only serving the commercial industry, which we know Shane Jones has strong ties to. And the commercial fishery lobby has totally got Shane Jones on board. And so it's absolutely fair that you're hearing this from other commentators on this issue, that, you know, we're seeing the impacts of lobbyists and going against the majority of people who are having their democratic say through things like submissions. I mean, 27,000 is a huge amount. There's countless people raising concerns, but all we're kind of left with now is really seeing this as an anti-democratic process. If people are raising concerns, saying that this is absolutely unnecessary and intolerable for the well-being of the future of the Māori of our vital ecosystems and for biodiversity to secure sustainable fisheries for future generations, and the Minister is still making these decisions to benefit industry, I think it's very clear. And another signal to that is another part of the Fisheries Amendment Bill around boats on cameras. So boats on cameras on commercial vessels was a huge win. It meant that we would have transparency around what the bycatch that was coming on board and what was happening to it and how much it was and how many hectares dolphins were coming onto boats, you know, really critically endangered species. And one of the other parts of this Fisheries Amendment Bill is that Shane Jones has put in there that anyone who leaks footage from the boats on cameras or any whistleblowers, say from MPI, will be fined $50,000. And so that's just trying to scare people away from showing the public what is happening on these vessels. And this is just another step towards just removing any accountability or transparency from the fishing industry for the general public and those with real concerns.
That was Forest and Bird National Conservation Advocate Bianca Ranson speaking to me about the Fisheries Act Amendment Bill and its impact on Aotearoa's oceans.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Buffalo Stance by Nene Cherry.
Scratching and give me a beat. Ouch! Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce the hi-hat. Go on. That's good. Now the tambourine. Right now. Sucking beer through straws, dropping down their drawers. Where did you get yours?
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Picky Picky by Geneva AM.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Research has recently been released which found between 1990 and 2023, ultra-processed foods' share in New Zealand's total food and drink imports has increased from 9 to 22%. This has raised concerns, as diets high in ultra-processed foods carry an increased risk of multiple serious health conditions and can be environmentally damaging due to their high usage of plastic packaging and water and energy in production. With the country in the midst of a cost of living crisis and people becoming increasingly reliant on these cheap, convenient, but unhealthy food options, the extent of this problem could continue to grow. To discuss the research and its findings, I talked to the report's lead author, Dr. Kelly Garten. Can you give us a brief overview about what this research was about and what it found?
Sure. So our study tracked food and non-alcoholic drink imports into New Zealand over 3.5 decades, so since 1990. And what we found is that there's been a massive increase in ultra-processed foods coming into the country. So ultra-processed foods are like industrial formulations made from cheap ingredients that are extracted from whole foods and combined with additives. So they mostly contain little to no whole food at all. So this is, for example, things like soft drinks, packaged sweet and savory snacks, and ready-to-eat meals. In our study, the proportion of food and beverage imports by weight that were ultra-processed rose from about 9% in 1990 to 22% in 2023. But in terms of imports per capita, this was 16 kilos per person in 1990, which then rose to 104 kilos per person in 2023. But these products aren't very good for us. This is a concern. Dietary patterns that are high in ultra-processed foods increase our risk of developing several serious health conditions like type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, chronic kidney disease, depression, and unhealthy weight gain, as well as increasing the risk of dying early. So it's showing us that we do have a growing problem of ultra-processed foods becoming more dominant in our food system.
And the report goes into multiple potential reasons for this ultra-processed food increase. One of its focuses is on how these products are marketed, particularly towards children. Can you explain why this is problematic and what actions the government could take to restrict this sort of marketing?
Yeah, a big problem with ultra-processed foods is that they're made to be super appealing, right, in terms of flavors and textures, but also colors, shapes, and smells. And studies have shown that they have addictive properties. Companies know they can hook kids on these early, and our kids are actually bombarded with marketing for these products throughout their day, whether it's, you know, on food packaging or bus stop ads or billboards outside the dairy, ads on TV or social media. And it works. That marketing exposure definitely influences kids to consume more. So we need to be doing more to protect them. Other countries like the UK have really taken the lead on restricting unhealthy food marketing with comprehensive junk food marketing bans across all media and settings. But all we have now in New Zealand is a voluntary advertising code that research has shown to be ineffective in protecting kids from harmful marketing. So we need our government to step up and regulate this properly.
Ultra-processed foods are also said to be made to be cheap and easy, aiming for a lower income consumer base. Can you touch on how these products impact poorer communities in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that ultra-processed food companies want to appeal to all consumers. A former CEO of Coca-Cola had this infamous quote that he said, they're competing not just with other soft drink brands, but they're competing against water. They're competing against tea, coffee, milk, and everything else that Americans consume, drinks that Americans consume in a day. So the aim is always maximum consumption. But being on limited income, especially during a cost of living crisis, does increase our reliance on cheaper, less perishable, and more convenient food. Many people have limited time. There's less intergenerational and community support these days as well, so our whole culture of eating has changed. But there's also a lot more availability and marketing in less advantaged communities. So our research, for example, in Tamaki Makaurau found that lower-income neighborhoods have more outdoor unhealthy food marketing and a higher density of fast food, takeaways, and dairies selling unhealthy ultra-processed food than more affluent ones.
The report also noted that there's been a lack of a national nutrition survey since 2008, and this means that ultra-processed food consumption data is absent in New Zealand. How important is this data, and how urgently should the government get onto this?
Yeah, it's very hard to do good food and nutrition policy when we don't have enough data.
So at the moment, we have very concerning health outcomes that tells us there's an issue here. And we have other bits of data like this import study that give us a general idea of what's happening. But we do desperately need a national nutrition survey to tell us not just about ultra-processed food consumption, but whether we're getting adequate nutrition, you know, micronutrients to live healthy lives, and what interventions might be needed to improve this.
The study also notes the environmental impacts of these products. Can you go into the detrimental effects that these products can have on our environment compared to whole foods, for example?
Yeah, I think the main thing is that ultra-processed foods rely very heavily on plastic packaging. So the waste generation is a very important environmental impact. I think it's important to note that some of these products can use large amounts of water and energy in processing as well. So that would be, you know, more than minimally processed whole foods. But another point is that these products are all based on cheap, high-yield commodity crops, so like maize, soy, and palm. These crops are known to have major deforestation and biodiversity impacts where they're grown. So looking at this from a food systems perspective, you do have environmental impacts across the board.
That was University of Auckland Senior Research Fellow Dr. Kelly Carton speaking to me about ultra-processed food imports increasing in New Zealand and the potential negative health outcomes that could come from this change.
That was The Wire.
Ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court, Professor Alistair Woodward, Forest and Bird National Conservation Advocate Bianca Ranson, and University of Auckland Senior Research Fellow Dr. Kelly Garton. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaroana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM, next up is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.